mouth, his tongue running along my bottom lip until my knees go weak. He pulls out my bun and runs his fingers through my hair. "Down," he murmurs, and I laugh. I step back with a teasing swish of my hips and pull my hair back. He shakes his head playfully. I take his hand and lead him into the kitchen where Penny is setting our plates. Mondays and Thursdays are for casual dining, ties undone at the kitchen island. My afternoon with Lydia has given me new perspective, reminded me of what I'm blessed with. Our entire apartment would have fit in this gourmet kitchen.
"Perfect, Penny. I had steak at a lunch meeting and I was worried you'd make red meat."
"Henry, Mondays are never beef." She pats his hand and turns on her heel, busying herself at the sink. Her short gray hair is pulled into a tight bun, and she's wearing jeans and a bulky sweater. She's borderline gaunt. I used to think that the help would wear uniforms, or call us sir or ma'am. My assumptions come from Evelyn. She was the help for more than one household in the Bay Area. She'd take the BART from Richmond to Berkeley and over to San Fran, a 2-hour one-way trip in the morning hours. I sometimes try to imagine Evelyn here, in Penny's place, and the picture slides from my mind, slippery as wet spaghetti. She talked of her employers with such formality, with reverence. Mr. Mishka, Mrs. Tanter. She didn't just respect them, she admired them. But Penny is different. She never feels like help. Penny feels like a mother, quietly taking care of Henry and me and never asking anything in return. I've overheard her with Henry, shockingly casual, even joking. She mocks him and he tolerates it. She's been with Henry's family since he was young. She knew his parents before they died. She knew his wife. She knows more about him than I do. She makes no bones about the fact that her loyalties lie with Henry. She isn't rude to me, but she's never overly friendly. I've caught her looking at me with a strange fascination, like a bug under a magnifying glass. When we first started dating, I asked Henry about it. "Penny really seems to not like me much at all." Henry's response was quiet, twirling pasta around his fork, studying his plate.
"She knows I pay her bills. If she doesn't get along with my new wife, it could ruin her lifestyle. She keeps her distance to protect herself, I'd guess."
"I wonder if she's in love with you." Henry laughed and dropped his fork.
"In love with me? She's at least 20 years older than I am."
"That means nothing," I protested. "You're 10 years older than me."
"Her husband is terribly disabled, you know. From a fire when I was a kid."
His mouth bowed in a frown.
"So tragic. She needs the money, Zoe."
And so I felt foolish, stupid and petty and foolish. Except sometimes she looks at us so oddly, as though she doesn't know who he is, like I am a specimen. She doesn't just look at me, she studies me. Then, when Henry and I are together, she barely glances my way at all. And once, I came into the kitchen just as I heard her saying, "Henry, but it isn't right. It doesn't look proper." And they had straightened up at the sight of me, Henry patting her shoulder and murmuring that they'd talk later. I knew she was talking about me, about my background, my mysterious past, rooted poverty. But before I could protest or ask her, she'd appear at my elbow, my dry cleaning in hand, the bottle of expensive shampoo I was almost out of but hadn't yet ordered, our social invitations categorized.
"How was your day?"
Henry is squeezing lemon over his salad, picking through the leaves with his fork. "It was interesting. I can't decide how much to tell him. Start with the worst. I was almost killed today." Henry's fork clangs on the marble countertop, and he stares at me with eyes rounded in fear, and I realize how reckless I've been, how careless. Tara. Penny has whirled around and her mouth hangs open. How cruel. "Oh, God, I'm sorry. That came out so awful." Henry clears his throat.
"What do you mean, killed?"
I place my hand on his arm, caress his wrist. "I'm sorry. I didn't think." Well, I was crossing a street and a car ran a red light and almost hit me. A reporter from the Post saved my life. I use the moment to get in an introduction to Cash as well. Not that meeting Cash for breakfast is off-limits or anything. Regardless of Lydia's attitude, Henry doesn't exert control. He's always exceedingly interested in how I spend my time, and he's protective. He means well.
A reporter?
He repeats. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have been so blunt about it. I forgot about, well, Tara. I was thoughtless. He wipes his lips, dabbing one side, then the other. After a moment, he sets his napkin down and pats my hand.
It's fine. Tara was part of my life, not yours. Tell me this again. A reporter saved your life?
I relay the story and am able to work in Cash's name again. He leans over and kisses me, and his lips taste like lemon and pepper.
I'm glad you're safe. People are crazy drivers.
His left hand rests on my thigh. How was your day? I spear a slice of tuna and put it in my mouth. He's watching me, and I lick olive oil off my upper lip.
Oh, the same as every day, I think.
Penny has her back to us and is storing the last of the dishes. She turns to face us, as usual, speaking to Henry, not me.
Do you need anything else before I leave?
She casts her eyes downward. I wonder what would happen if I yelled, screamed, talked to her directly, anything. I wonder where she goes, who she goes home to. Does her husband live with her? I imagine her in a house in Queens, an invalid husband sequestered to a bedroom, small and dingy, surrounded by 15 cats, all named for Disney characters. Captain Hook eats all the tuna. She talks to them in her whispered, lilting voice, still young-sounding, while they mewl and knead at her lap. Henry doesn't flinch.
Penny, thank you. This is wonderful. Enjoy your evening.
Penny gives me a quick head nod and a goodbye, never, ever saying my name. I'm not sure she's ever said it. And I hear the petite footsteps to the door. The latch clicks into place. I turn to face Henry, and his eyes go dark, and for a moment that seems to last hours, we just stare at each other.
Who is this Cash?
Henry asks as he slides over, pushing his plate back. He tugs at my hand, pulls me against him and into his lap. I straddle him, but pull away a notch. He only seems to want me to be desperate like this when he thinks he's being encroached upon. I saw Lydia today. I play with the buttons of his shirt, tapping them with my nail. I want to tell him about the flower shop, my idea of going back, how it could silence this suffocating notion that I'm not accomplishing anything. I'm going to be 30 years old and I don't have a career anymore. Or friends. Or anything else that other 30-year-olds have. He pulls my hand up and kisses my palm. I was thinking I could go back to the flower shop. 1, 2 days a week. There's not enough to do with care to fill a whole week. I need to do something.
You do?
He agrees and kisses my neck, and then I realize he's being facetious. He means him. No, Henry, I'm serious. I lean back away from him, but he smiles. A warm, open, come-on-in smile. I love this Henry, the one who is undone, his face reminding me of a child's, full of hope and wanting. He slides his hands down to my waist and lifts me onto the marble countertop. His hands trace circles on my thighs, and I feel my irritation fading, being replaced with a building want. This is what he does when I try to talk to him. He tugs my blouse free, and his hands inch up my ribcage. His touch is electric. Every feather light graze sends my skin zinging. He knows this, and his lips curl up in a satisfied smile. But I am happiest when I'm the tormentor. He grips my shoulders, and his head falls to my lap. When he lifts up again, he stares into my eyes, his hands cupping my cheeks so tight it borders on painful.
I can't lose you, too.
His voice rumbles, low and keening. He runs his thumb across my bottom lip. I bite it softly. Henry, you're not going to lose me. I clear my throat.
I know you want your freedom, to fly and do your own thing. I know I hold you back. I'm sorry. Just have patience. Wait for me.
Henry, I touch under his chin with my index finger. You were with Tara when she died, right? Holding me back won't stop anything from happening to me. Do you realize that? We all have to live our lives.
I never thought I'd love anyone again. I'm not a lovable man. I thought I had my one chance and it was over.
I slide off the counter onto his lap and face him. I kiss his cheeks, his closed eyes. Nothing will happen to me. I can feel him through the thin fabric of his suit pants, hard and insistent, and I put my hand there, lightly scratching with my nails. His eyes flutter back. I untangle myself and take his hand. Let's go upstairs. We leave the dinner plates on the counter, the wine untouched, almost like we were never there. Later, our legs woven together, Henry's hand caresses my belly. His face is in my neck. His breathing is sporadic, sometimes regular and steady like he's sleeping, but then he startles and pulls me into him like he can't get close enough. My stomach rumbles and I think of our salads wilting on the island. I want pizza, I blurt out. He lifts his head sleepily.
Pizza?
Yes, from a pizzeria.
We don't do that. Okay. Order pizza, then.
He wraps his leg around me, pinning me to the bed and pretends to doze. I struggle to push him off and giggle. I extract myself and slide into one of Henry's workout t-shirts. He pushes himself up on his elbows and watches me, bending his head to glimpse the crescent of bottom peeking out from beneath the hem of his shirt. He gives me a low whistle and a quick pat on the bare skin. I wave him off. From the bathroom, I order delivery. My chest is bursting with a skittered giddiness. I realize I hadn't finished telling him about my visit with Lydia. The afternoon feels so far away, like it happened to another person. I have a sudden stab of pity for her, with her scoffing superiority and preconceived notions about what makes a loving relationship, with no concept of the give and take. She would likely never feel full with love like this. She'd never allow herself to see the flaws of a man, to accept them, to bend herself in any way to accommodate them. She'd never realize it was a two-way street, the way the right man would bend to accommodate her, molding himself around her until they fit together, just right. When the pizza comes, I pull on shorts to answer the door and then scamper back to the bedroom with paper towels. Henry sits up in bed, wrapping the sheets around his waist and stares at me in wonder.
I honestly think it's been 20 years since I ate pizza in bed.
He pulls up a slice and takes a large bite, cheese dripping down his chin. I situate the box between us. I'm suddenly famished. We chew in silence. I realize I have no idea what time it is. So, about Lydia. I study the box in front of me, wondering what his response will be. He is sufficiently plied with pizza and sex, his legs in a loose V, our ankles crossed.
The punk girl, right? I remember Lydia.
Was he not listening at all in the kitchen? I try not to be exasperated. I miss having a girlfriend. I don't talk to her much anymore.
Well, you have different ideas now. You're a rich woman in a different world. She's not. It drives a wedge between a lot of people.
It's more than that. I pull my ankle back and cross it under me, tugging at the hem of his t-shirt. I pick imaginary crumbs off the blankets.
Oh?
He raises an eyebrow. Henry, do you like her? I choose my words carefully, picking through the minefield that is a delicate subject with Henry. Again, I sense the closing door before it's confirmed.
I have no feelings about her whatsoever, Zoe.
He sits up straighter, his face pulled in, becoming Henry again.
You can do as you like with whomever you like.
The kind of person who says things like, as you like and whomever, versus the guy who smacked my bare bottom 20 minutes ago.
all these quick-changing people like stage actors in a play.
You've never seemed to approve. I put my pizza down and touch his hand. He looks at it blankly.
I approve, Zoe. It's fine.
He stands up, gathers the pizza box and the crumpled paper towels, and sweeps crumbs from the white comforter. He mumbles something that sounds like crumbs in bed. I feel panicky. I'm losing him. I make a calculated decision. She reminded me of something I forgot about. I straighten the pillows, going for nonchalant. When you and I met, I had just started digging, trying to find Carolyn. I was striking out. He is staring at me, his eyes wide, his expression a marble wall. I rush on. I wonder if you can help me now. You're rich, powerful, connected. Henry loves more than anything to be a hero and a celebrated one. Nothing gets him going quite like, can you help me? I expect this to work, to be the bridge between us, to bring him back to bed, his ankles over mine, his face in my neck as he brainstorms about who he knows that could help locate her and how we could do it, who he could pay. We'll hire the best PI I can find. I genuinely believe this. Instead, his mouth is set, his jaw working.
Why am I not enough, Zoe?
His hands hang down by his sides, but his fists are clenching and unclenching.
Oh, honey, no. I just meant...
I know what you meant.
He slaps the bed hard, and I jump back.
In the course of one evening, you tell me you were almost killed. You've connected with an old friend, someone shady and who looks like a common criminal, and now you want to reach back into your past and find your birth mother. Even though, by your own admission, your past is shrouded in secrecy and vague and you have no living relatives. We've made a goddamn life, Zoe.
I'm stung by his words, his assessment of our evening and how drastically different it is from mine. Henry, I'm telling you this because I feel close to you. Please, just listen.
I said you can do anything you want to do. I mean that. But you are restless. You are not content in our life. With everything we have, you want more. You bring up this Carolyn every time I turn around. She's the woman who left you. I am the man who is here, and it will never be enough.
His eyes flash with anger, and he spits the words at me.
Henry, no!
I shout. I can't help it. He's not even listening to me. This all seems ridiculous. He obviously doesn't understand what I'm talking about, what I'm asking.
Don't you... dare raise your voice to me like that.
He says it slowly, low and scary, and I shrink back. I've never been afraid of Henry before.
Henry, I'm happy here. I will not be stagnant my whole life. You can't keep me in this marble box of an apartment.
I speak slowly and clearly. I smart at his words, the woman who left you, but I won't tell him that. We stand off, facing each other, both of us in identical poses, his hands on his hips for several minutes. His nostrils flare. The pizza is cloying, greasy and sickening.
I just want to be enough for you, Zoe. This is my biggest fear, that I'm not.
He drops his arms to his sides and turns his back to me. I cross the room and touch his bare back. His skin feels cold.
You're enough for me.
I touch my nose to his spine and inhale.
I'm not. I won't be. You'll leave. I'll be alone.
That's crazy.
I wrap my arms around his waist. I won't leave you simply because I find her. That's crazy. I don't even know if she'll want to know me.
So this is Lydia. This is her idea. You've started mentioning Lydia and Carolyn at the same time. We've spent the last year in this world. It's different social circles, though. She'll drag you backward into her scene again.
What? I have no mind of my own? I pull him closer. I love you.
He pats my hand, then pulls out of my embrace. He doesn't turn to look at me and instead sighs.
Now. You love me now.
Henry, love isn't conditional on growth.
If I make a new friend or find my birth mother, it doesn't mean I'll move on or outgrow you.
You're an exotic bird, Zoe. You don't see that.
This is crazy, Henry. I'll love you no matter what.
I'm not ready, Zoe. I'm not ready for us to reach back into our pasts. We've been living in this bubble, living in the present. I've loved it. I spent the whole year before I met you completely living in the past. I can't look back, not yet. Can you see that? Can you give me time?
Time, I repeat. The word seems senseless.
Yes, time. Let me figure it out. Then maybe I'll even help you. We can do it together. But I just need to be ready. There's a lot you don't know about me. I know that, and it's my fault. I've kept myself from you. Parts that I haven't been ready to access. It hasn't been fair, but...
He shrugs.
It is what it is.
Okay. I nod slowly. I don't really understand, but I know that real love is about sacrifice, understanding, giving when you just want to take. I guess I can give you time, even though I have no idea what that means. He pulls me into a fierce hug, his arms around me like a vice. I can't be sure, but I think I feel tears on my hair.
I won't let you go. Not again.
Chapter 7. February 2013, New York City.
You have a date? In my hands I clutched a fistful of wilting anthurium, with their veined, leathery, leaf-like petals, a masculine flower. Phallic, really, the stamen popping out like a penis.
It's a corporate banquet, Lydia's eyes plead. It's a big date. You'll be fine.
Elisa hates me. She's going to hate this, I grumble, pouting, smoothing out the last of the bouquets. Elisa criticizes the way I change water buckets. I picture her smooth, blonde-gray ponytail swinging as she shakes her head, her lined mouth bowed down as she ticks off on slender fingers all the things I should have done differently in her clipped, efficient accent. Elisa is 5 feet tall and 60 years old, and my hands shake at the thought. Javi waits in the truck, honks twice impatiently.
That's why you're not going to tell her.
Lydia kisses my cheek and pats my head, like I'm a dog.
You were going to go with me anyway. Now you're just... in charge.
Elisa's going to flip shit, and you know it. He better be worth it.
He's not. If I'm not home by midnight, I've been roofied, okay?
She waggles her fingers at me and is out the door, the tinkle of the bell signaling her exit. As he steers the van, Javi talks a blue streak, gossiping about Elisa, Paula, his partner-slash-girlfriend, even Lydia. I, in all the right places, but eventually he gives up and we sit in silence in hot, beeping traffic. Lydia's right. It's just a corporate event. But I'm jittery and I wipe my palms on my jeans. I think of all the things I'm going to do wrong. I've been working at Le Fleur de Lis for almost 3 years now, and I still don't have my footing. My job feels precarious at best, charitable at worst. Most, if not all, of my suggestions are met with an outward sigh. I'm still the new kid, the apprentice. The dinner is small, 25 people in a restaurant called Brulé in Tribeca. All I have to do is place centerpieces and a podium-potted plant and leave. The arrangements are all ugly, corporate and masculine, the rounded globes of hydrangeas, the long tapered gladiolus. Literally, all cock and balls against deep blood-red table settings. I can almost smell the self-congratulatory sweat. I position the last table setting, only 4 in all, and 1 hand bouquet, presumably a gift. White, lilting, and feminine. I guess it's for someone's assistant. I turn to leave and crash directly into someone coming through the door. A flurry of gift bags scatters on the floor, their contents spreading a remarkable distance, flinging under tables and chairs. Oh my God, I'm so sorry,
I panic. This will be the thing that Elisa knows about, that she fires me for. The man bends over, gathers up the flung silk scarves and pen boxes. His hair is shiny blonde, and when he looks up at me, he smiles, all teeth and dimples. My heart lurches.
No worries. Nothing breakable. Help me rewrap.
He motions toward the long table where he stacks 10 gift bags in various states of crumpled. I hesitate. Since I've been working at Elisa's, I've been around some very rich people. Florists are hired help, as invisible as janitors, maids, and interns. Clients may respect the designers, temporarily treat them as equals, but never the drivers. I'm merely the one delivering the masterpieces of the designer, in this case, Lydia. The man studies the centerpieces.
Did you design these?
I shake my head. I can almost feel Lydia elbow my side. If I'm the lead here, I'm the designer. I handle the criticism, take the praise. He grins.
Good. They're god-awful. What are these black flowers?
Bat orchids. Yes, black flowers. My tongue feels thick, unwieldy. He reaches out, taps my arm.
Sit. Help me. My assistant wrapped all these. I'm hopeless at wrapping things. You must be good at it.
Because I'm a woman? I wrinkle my nose.
Because you're in design?
He corrects carefully. My neck flushes red. He leans toward me, his long eyelashes lowered, dusting his cheeks. He smells spicy, full of oak and power and something musky, like the inside of a tree trunk. He passes me gift bags, and I carefully wrap pens and silk scarves back into delicate tissue paper. Our fingers touch with each pen box, all 10, and then we're done. Too soon, it feels like. I smooth my palms on my jeans and clap my hands together, too loudly for some weird reason, as though he's a kindergartner. He gives me an odd look. Looks like I'll be leaving, I say. He closes the space between us.
Stay. Be my date for this horrible, boring, boorish dinner, where everyone will talk about who they've fucked and fucked over. You can tell me about bat orchids.
I can't. Tonight? No, I don't have anything to wear. I have plans. I have a book to read. Just... no. I back up, feeling the wall behind me for the door. You don't even know my name. Comes out like a question, or possibly an invitation. He laughs, a deep yet light sound.
I'm Henry Whittaker. What's your name?
Henry Whittaker? I know who you are. I swallow twice, the doorknob under my hand. Working with a high-end event florist means we know who's who in Manhattan. We gossip about the major traders and real estate moguls the way other millennials follow the Kardashians.
I'm famous, then? Does that impress you?
He steps closer to me, his face cracked in a grin. He's joking, teasing me. No, you're a player. That doesn't impress me. I turn the handle and back through the door. Have fun, though, really. I don't need to be added to the list of women you've fucked or fucked over or whatever you said. I back through the banquet room door and into the main restaurant where waitstaff are setting tables for dinner service. A few of them look up startled. I rush through the dining room and from behind me Henry calls,
"Wait! I was kidding!"
I push through the doors and into the street where Javi waits with the van, the bass thumping. I fling open the door and heave myself in the front seat.
"Just drive!"
I look back to see Henry standing in front of Brulé, watching the van peel away, his hand raised in a jaunty wave. Back at La Fleur de Lys, I clean up. Putter, wash buckets, rinse bins, inventory, foam bricks, wire, beads, dusting spray. I have nowhere to go. I could go home, rattle around the apartment, wait for Lydia and her terrible date. The worst that could happen is that she'd come home, draw the curtain between our beds, and engage in raucous sex. No thanks. The bell clangs out front, and I dump the last bucket before wiping my hands on my apron and making my way out front. Henry Whittaker stands in the showroom, eyeing the refrigerator filled with arrangements. I stop and stare, unable to find the right words, the right tone. Haughty? Bitchy? Funny? When he sees me, he smirks.
These are your plans?
He gently extends his hand, a large white box wrapped with a red bow. What is this? I tilt my chin at him, but I don't take the box.
A book and a dress?
He bows slightly.
Zoe Swanson?
I push my hair out of my eyes. How did you...
I have connections.
I can't tell if he's serious. He sighs, sets the box on the counter, and pushes it with one finger in my direction.
Go on. Open it.
I do. On top of a pile of tissue paper sits a book. I pick it up, turn it over in my hands. Anna Karenina? I raise my eyebrows.
What's not to love? Suburban unrest in 19th century Russia?
I set the book aside. It's old. I wonder briefly what edition. I wonder if he somehow knew it was my favorite or if it was just a guess. A guess. The dress underneath is heavy, beaded, and eggplant. The book was a hit. The dress? A miss. Eggplant is my least favorite color, I tell him. Rude, Evelyn would be appalled.
It's not eggplant. I prefer to think of it as bat orchid.
I can't help but laugh at this. Truly, men in general are fairly bad at banter. I've spent many a night tossing out jokes to good-looking dates only to have them fall flat on the two-top table between us with a puzzled smile. Henry is surprising. He elaborates.
I heard once that there's no such thing as black flowers, that if you were to breed a true black, you'd make $1 million, that all flowers are really deep shades of purple. Some might say, dark eggplant. Is that true?
He steps closer to me, his chest inches from my face. He doesn't seem to care about personal space or social acceptability or my not-so-subtle back-off signals. He doesn't know how much I loathe the touch of strangers. That's true, I whisper. But you already have $1 million. I've turned into that girl. The one who plays it cool, then gives in, much too quickly. The coy temptress turns giggly. I straighten my shoulders, try to get it back.
I do, he whispers back. Come with me, please.
I need to shower and do my hair, makeup. I live all the way in Hoboken, I protest weakly.
Come to my apartment. I'll give you all the privacy in the world, I promise. I have a car.
No, I can't. I smooth the back of my hair flat against my skull, a nervous tick.
What do you want? What would make you come with me?
His voice is so earnest and his eyes so pleading that I almost cave right there. I do cave internally. It's over. Hook, line, sinker. My idea of dating is going home with the drummer of a band, tiptoeing past his roommate passed out on the sofa, and try to have quiet orgasms and later quieter escapes. I rarely proffer a phone number. I like this, my distant, detached life. I slant my eyes at him, coquettish for fun. Convince me. He laughs, his head tipped back until I can see the inside of his mouth behind his teeth.
You want me to woo you, then?
I place my hand on my forehead, a mock swoon. Exactly. Woo me. He leads me out into his car, which is waiting for my inevitable yes. I wonder if his driver has ever seen anyone say no. We drive to his apartment, which is appropriately spectacular, shiny and glossy with high ceilings and gleaming surfaces. Modern furniture, tall windows, rooms as big as my entire apartment. I follow him to a guest room, complete with an ensuite bathroom. The shower I use would hold my entire bathroom. By the time I'm dressed and trussed and fluffed, I feel like Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, minus the whole prostitution thing. An array of cosmetics, all new, waits for me to pick and choose. The whole setup leaves me baffled. Does he just keep all this, waiting for a woman? Is this his shtick? Then I figure, what do I care? I envision my dark apartment. When I emerge into the hallway, he gasps. If there is a script for this movie, this moment in my life, it would have been written exactly as it played out. My heart hammers and my hands shake. And I know in that instant, like the sappiest of romance movies, that this man will change my life. At dinner, he is attentive. It's his dinner, I learn. He's the host. He barely pays attention to anyone else. Do you need more water, more sorbet, another glass of wine? I laugh and wave him off. You wanted me to woo you, so I'm wooing you. He hovers, this man, in his god-expensive suit and finely crafted leather shoes. His colleagues are curious, I imagine, about the defiant-looking girl with the pierced eyebrow and the spiky hair wearing an elegant dress. They are kind but dismissive. Henry doesn't tell them what I do for a living, that I'm practically hired help. His assistant is nice, in a self-serving way, as though he cast Henry as Daddy Warbucks and me as Annie, and maybe, just maybe, his good deed will make the paper. I catch his eye throughout the night, and he winks in a way I presume he means to be reassuring but does nothing to reassure me. A woman in the group, blonde, coiffed, peaches and cream skin, simpers next to Henry. Her long red fingernails dance along his hairline as she shoots looks in my direction. He floats back momentarily and then leans close to me, his breath curling around my ear.
Don't worry about Diana. She's not nearly as attractive as she thinks she is.
After dinner, there are speeches and some mingling, but Henry peppers me with questions, rarely leaving my side. A man has never been so goddamned interested in everything I have to say. We take his car home and he sits in the back with me but doesn't make a move. I can't tell if I'm impressed or disappointed. He never flinches at my little run-down Hoboken neighborhood with the exposed fire escapes and barred windows. He walks me to the door with a chaste, gentle kiss on the lips, quick and soft as a feather. His pursuit after that night is relentless, hungry, primal. He can't stop thinking about me, he says. He whisks me away. Madrid, London, Los Angeles. I accompany him on business trips, and each time he presents me with a new glittering gown. Strappy sandals, 5-carat diamond necklaces, teardrop sapphire earrings. Everything he can offer on display. The Wheel of Fortune with your host, Henry Whittaker. All this doggedness wears me out. I say this to him. Henry, I can't be the woman you want me to be, who will fit in your circles, go to your parties, be your arm candy. This is not a relationship that can work. He says he's never loved anyone like this, so quickly, so intensely. He loves everything about me, he tells me. He comes to the flower shop sometimes just to watch me work, late at night, working with a new bloom, willing new thick stems to bend, not break. Trying to learn design, self-teaching, needing the elusive respect of Elisa. He takes home all my creations, successful or not, and sets them on his glass dining room table, prominently displayed at dinner parties. He calls me brilliant to his friends. Sometimes I think he's lost his mind. They surely think that too. Me, with my hair spiked like, well, a bad orchid, and dyed just as black. With my facial piercings and my fishnet stockings and knee-high boots, with my too short skirts and my dubious taste in music, my suspect circle of friends, acquaintances mostly, Lydia's friends, but most of them not so arrow straight, some who dabble in drugs. I've heard his colleagues say things, seen their looks. They smirk when they think I'm not looking, but I see it. I'm a dangerous hobby, an expensive yacht. I'm a midlife crisis. He's slumming and getting off on it. I see it. They see it. Henry doesn't. I tell him this and he just shakes his head.
You don't know me. I've never followed a crowd in my life.
So? He takes me. He takes all of it, never faltering, absorbing Lydia's sarcasm and attitude, her jealousy, with a resonant laugh and twinkling blue eyes. That subtle dimple that only appears when he's most amused, the way he pinches my chin, the way I can put on a show all seductive kitten and make him late for a meeting, a meeting he was running, no less, just by using a whispered kiss of a voice. He rushes home, taking me in the hallway, unable to wait. He thought about it all day, he says. I have no idea what to make of any of it. Slowly, I fall. I fall until I'm down at the bottom of the barrel, so deep in love with those twinkling eyes and those dimples. I'm drunk on my own power, and his money, and the world he holds, all for me. He offers it in one hand without pretense, while holding his heart in the other. I want both. I take both. I let myself go. I stop pointing out that his friends and his colleagues laugh at me. I stop saying no. I stop protesting his indulgence when he buys me clothing and shoes and jewelry. I stop looking for the catch. There doesn't seem to be one. So what do you do? He rents out Brulee, where we met, and fills it with flowers from Elisa's. In that back room, he gets down on one knee and delivers a speech that ends any doubt. He wants me for me, he claims. I don't believe it, but he repeats again and again, "You wanted me to woo you, so here I am." It's all so hard to argue with. I say yes, crying and blubbering. Everyone wants to be loved for who they are, even if we keep our true selves locked up and hidden. It's a nice little fantasy to believe that the right person holds the key, and all the things you do not say are just somehow magically known. I justified it then, keeping Hillary a secret. I suppose I justify it now. It's been so long. I'm Zoe now, what does it matter? There are parts of my life I'd like to never think about again, even when it seems like all I do is actively avoid thinking about them. Evelyn, a barbaric burial. Rosie, abused, exploited. Those little pink nails, all those suburban moms reaching for me, petting my hands, wanting what I could offer, but never wanting me. Then comes our wedding, small and private, his friends excluded. Mostly because I think I'm not acceptable. He says no, insists it's a bad time of year. Everyone summers in the Hamptons. Our honeymoon. Lavish. A world tour. 2 months, maybe longer. All love and sex and sharing ice cream, giggling, drinking champagne. My ship finally came in. At some point, Evelyn always said, everyone's does. We stroll the Gran Via in Madrid, eat gelato, throw coins over our shoulders into the Trevi Fountain in Rome, spend hours in the Modern Art Museum in Geneva. We spend months together, never tiring of each other. He hangs on my every word, caters to my whims. It's so easy to fall in love with Henry Whittaker. His easy smile, his lifestyle, his profligate praise and unabating interest, his strong, capable hands, and the way they caress my body. He offers what I've been so desperate for, a root. He offers money, which I've never had, security, so long missing. He fills the gaps that Evelyn created when she left me alone at night in a tiny apartment in a bad section of town to go to work or on a date, but either way, not there to soothe my fears, push the wet hair off my perspiring forehead at 3 a.m. when I'd heard gunshots or had yet another nightmare. He offers me love, a boundless amount of it, as though everything I say amuses him or entertains him, and as though he understands exactly what I mean. We watch documentaries on National Geographic, and I test him by saying ridiculous things like, "Do you think elephants are the communists of the animal kingdom?" He offers me recognition, where I'd often only felt isolation, trying on different identities, college girl, druggie, punk hipster. He offers me all this on a shiny silver serving tray. One might wonder, as I often did, what exactly could I offer Henry Whittaker? Chapter 8. Lately, no matter what I am doing, going to care meetings, attending lunches, I find myself scanning the crowd for women who look like me. Dark hair streaked naturally with mahogany, and pale blue eyes the color of pool water. The sales clerk at Blush's boutique has a lovely sprinkling of freckles across her cheeks, youthful for her age, in a recognizable pattern. And I study her until she shifts uncomfortably, averting her eyes and self-consciously patting her short, stiff hair back into place. Maybe she always called me dear for a reason. I repeat, I am being ridiculous like a mantra as I stomp around the apartment, but I can't help it. I'm restless and bored and can't shake the thoughts rattling around in my brain. A large hall closet houses stacks of crates that contain remnants of our life before each other. I once asked Henry to show me his memories with Tara, his circle of friends. I saw once, quickly, some photos of beautiful people in tailored clothing on the back of a yacht, a picture-perfect ad for champagne or an investment firm. He always said, "Some other time," with a casual shrug. The pictures were squirreled away. I've mostly given up. In the back of this closet is my box. Singular. Pink and black striped. An old, humongous hat box holds all the remnants of my old self, and even my old, old self. I've been so many people I can barely keep track, and this singular, crazy-looking container is all I have to show for it. The top is dusty and I lift it, letting the bottom fall back onto my bed in protest. Inside is paperwork, old and new, yellowed and dog-eared. There isn't much, and most of it was kept for reasons I can't fathom. There's a cable bill from my old apartment with Lydia, pictures of Lydia and me drinking martinis at clubs, hazy with smoke, laughing with men I don't recognize or remember. It's the spontaneity that calls me now. The idea of not knowing where my nights would take me, whose bed I would wake up in, when I would find my way home and how. That my life ever held so much easy adventure amazes me. I have squirreled away an envelope that used to belong to Hillary. I was never supposed to keep it. I was advised to get rid of everything that could link me to my old identity by Detective Maslow, a kind but harried man with haphazard glasses and too long hair. He never looked like a violent crimes detective to me. He wasn't grizzled. He wasn't hard-boiled. He looked like an exhausted tax accountant. In the beginning, his wife called once while I was in his office. I was under the impression she called often. At the time, I was terrified, living in a halfway house. No identity, no name to speak of. That murky middle time before I became Zoe. Hillary ceased to exist the moment I signed the affidavit. But deciding to become Zoe took some time. "We can protect you," he said. I pressed my back against the chair. I remember it was leather, too rich for a city office, and cracked black, while Maslow sternly explained in detail all I would need to surrender, which was everything. When he picked up the phone, he lowered his tone to a sniveling murmur with a series of "yes, dears." I realized Milton Maslow didn't have the conviction to protect me. I wondered how many me's there were, how many men, women, children he had vowed to shield sitting behind his desk, buried in the paperwork of forgotten identities. "No, thank you very much. I'd manage on my own." I testified at the grand jury a mere 10 days later. I packed in the middle of the night, and I ran. I took the money they gave me. The money that was meant to start me off in witness protection? A mere $1,000. I bought a bus ticket with cash to New York, the only place I could think of where I could hide in plain sight. Plus, it was as far away from California as a person could get. I left my dingy hotel room in the middle of the night, and left Milton Maslow bumbling around in his office. I felt only a little bad, so I left him a note. "Thanks for everything. Bright lights, big city." He could puzzle it out. I pick up a thick manila envelope now and peel away the tape. I haven't looked inside it in at least 5 years. Inside is a single picture of Hillary. Hair dyed with streaks of blonde, a big wide-open smile, a happy college girl. A California girl. I wonder who she would have become if she hadn't become me. I can't deny it's complicated. I sift through photos of Evelyn. Beautiful, nurturing, gentle. My memories of her are tinted pink and soft around the edges,
even the lean years after she got sick and couldn't work, and I wore jeans until my ankles stuck out. She thinned down to nothing, smaller than me, a child in an adult bed. But by then I'd turned 18. I studied her pictures. I'd saved 3. One of her holding me as an infant, my father beaming behind her, the man who died before I could remember him, a slick road, a careening car, an ill-placed tree, I think. Hard to remember. I was so young when he died. All I have is Evelyn's voice telling whispered stories under the blankets with the lights off. "I was wanted," she said. I've never doubted it, which I hear is a strange thing. I've read articles on the psychology of adoption and never connected with any of them. Evelyn's ovaries dried up and plain stopped working, she told me, a predecessor to the ovarian cancer that would later take her life. But she'd twist her wrist with a tinkling laugh. "They call infertility a curse. Was the best thing that ever happened to us. We got you." The second picture is Evelyn and me at the beach. I was maybe 14, and we are hugging and smiling. I never went through that all-too-common phase when teenagers hate their mothers. I could never imagine my life without her. Until, of course, I had to. The third picture is after she got sick. Our last picture together. Her head wrapped in one of her paisley scarves, her hair wispy fine underneath. She's grinning wildly into the camera with her hands on my face. I'm not smiling, but studying her, like at any moment she might poof, be gone, and I'd have only that moment to have memorized her face. Evelyn lived her life in full force. She rejected all things mediocre, preferring only to spectacularly succeed or fail. She'd always said that she didn't quite do things right, but she didn't do them half-assed either, so when she failed, she did so with enthusiasm. Her advice to me always, win or lose, do it enthusiastically. I feel my eyes well up, and for the first time in a long time, missing her fills me up, and I'm crying. I shove the pictures back in the envelope and ungracefully wipe my nose on my sleeve, which even Henry's wife can do when alone. I thumb through the rest, quickly, until I find what I'm looking for. It's a yellowed copy of a birth certificate with the name of a hospital, Griffin Hospital, Derby, Connecticut, on the top. The father line is unsigned, a blank reminder that I belong to no one. The mother line, a haphazardly scrawled Carolyn Seaver. The date is there, May 3rd, 1985. And my birth name is there. The first person I ever was before I became someone else. I run my finger along the raised letters. Zoe Griffin. Evelyn told me the nurses named me Zoe after one of their favorite patients. Griffin came from the hospital name. After my biological mother gave birth, she left me in the nursery. Sometimes I feel as though I am made up almost entirely of secrets. But the one that no other living soul knows is that I took my name back. Before there was Hillary, there was the baby Zoe, abandoned in a Connecticut hospital. After there was Hillary, there was a grown-up Zoe, living in an ivory tower. Sometimes I wonder how all three of us can possibly fit in this one body. Haphazardly, I shove all the remaining papers back into the box and replace the lid. I hold on to the birth certificate and a folded-up memo from a defunct adoption agency that is fairly useless. The name on the birth certificate is a dead end, a false identity she'd left in a panic. I know this much from my last search effort. I tip the box on its side and place it back in the corner behind Henry's things. I see Tara scrawled in pen on the side of one of the crates. And I can't help it. I lift the lid. I've seen it before, of course. But yet, I've never snooped. I don't know why I snoop now. Inside sit stacks of folders. Insurance, trust account, taxes labeled with the year. I thumb through them quickly. It's all very dry. Underneath the folders is a frame, and my heart skips. I've never seen a picture of her. Isn't that odd? Not one single photo of Henry's wife, his precious Tara. I have no idea what she looks like, other than one drunken night when I had the nerve to ask Henry. He got this faraway look and murmured, "Beautiful." I've been curious, and I grab it. The photo is taken from behind. Her head is turned. I can barely make out her profile. Her hair is loose in waves down her back, but covered with a wispy white veil. It is of their wedding day, and the jealousy surges, this awful clawing, clamping tightness in my throat. Her dress is fitted. She's impossibly thin, elegant, in an ivory fishtail gown. I shove the frame back under the files. I back out of the closet, the bile in my throat. I push sideways the idea of being threatened by a swatch of bare spine and a mane of thick hair. With the birth certificate and the adoption agency memo in one hand, I call Cash. He picks up before the phone even rings. "Hi, it's Zoe. I was following up about the story, if you finished it." He pauses.
"Yeah, mostly. I had a few other questions. Would you want to meet for lunch?"
I agree, but suggest a coffee shop closer to my apartment than his office. Neither one of us suggests the diner, and the conversation is stilted. He asks if I'm okay. I feign surprise. "I'm fine," I say brightly. We agree to meet at noon. I check my watch, and it's 10 after 10. I tuck paperwork into my purse, fold it into a square small enough to fit in the pocket. I feel guilty, lying to Henry. Honestly, I'm not even sure what I'm doing yet. The lie feels good, fits like a well-made winter coat. I step out into the sun, and the air is brisk. It smells woodsy out, that faint promise of summer. I skip step to the curb to hail a taxi, and change my mind. I walk the 6 blocks, and before I realize it, I turn west. Henry works out every day at 11:30. 5 miles on the treadmill, 100 push-ups, 100 sit-ups. Exactly 1 hour, not including the shower. His gym is across the street from his office, and I stand in front of it, hopping from one foot to the other. I've never surprised him like this. Henry doesn't particularly care for surprises. His words,
"I don't particularly care for surprises."
Sometimes I think about the Henry who wooed me, buoyant and boyish, and I remember that he liked surprises. I can't tell if I've been conned or if all relationships slow to the everyday, if marriages settle and become mundane at some point. To some extent, everyone puts on a show, their best foot forward, smiling at hobbies they hate, pretending to love football teams they couldn't care less about, or eating sushi and secretly spitting it into a napkin. I hover in front of the door. I'm not even sure I can get in the building without a membership badge, which I don't have. He's never asked me to join him. I'm still trying to figure out why I'm here when a group of 2 men and 2 women barge through the doors, talking and laughing. I scoot behind them and let the mirrored doors close behind me. The lobby is austere, with mirrored walls, floors, ceilings, white and black countertops, and a single 20-foot tree stretching up to the ceiling. I follow the group down the hall and skirt away before I reach the locker room. At the end of the hall is another entrance into one of the main gyms, and the last 20 feet of hallway is a one-way mirror, presumably for prospective clients to view the amenities without current members feeling put on display. My mouth goes dry, and I involuntarily place my hand against the wall, the heat from my fingertips leaving condensation prints against the cold glass. Henry is in there, his movements quick and smooth, his back muscles flexing with each up and down. Push-ups are last. He's close to done. If he makes a move toward the lobby or toward the locker room, I'll reveal myself as a pleasant surprise. Maybe blow Cash off and grab a middle-of-the-week lunch with Henry. He stands up and gulps water, and I watch him lean in, whisper to a cultish blonde on the mat next to him. She throws her head back as though he said something hilarious, which I know could never be true because Henry is not funny. At least, not recently. But something about him is different to me. He's loose-jointed, almost swaggering, a hand poised cockily on one jutted hip. I lean forward until my nose is almost touching the glass. Henry cracks another joke and the blonde swats at his arm.
He reaches out and pats her bottom, her round, perfect, pink spandexed bottom, and hovers there, his fingers gently flexing on the rounded swell. The heat flushes my face and I back away from the window. Men flirt. It's how it is. I still feel dizzy and I put